Interestingly, it's very often a break in the social structure that renders people houseless, much more than it is the loss of a job or addiction, or these are sort of follow-up problems.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Louisa Snyder is an assistant professor at the Free University in Amsterdam and research partner at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in Halle, where she leads a research project on intimate relationships, privacy, violence, and the state-citizen engagement among unhoused persons in Germany. Overall, she is interested in examining the frictions between people's theoretical rights and their practical realisation that arise from the divide between private and public spheres through the politico-legal separation between home, house, and street, and through conflicts over which areas of life the state may regulate, and which matters are considered to be inviolable. She has carried out research in Europe and Sierra Leone since 2011.
Thank you.
Hi, Louisa. Really pleased to meet you. And thanks so much for joining us today for this conversation. You've researched several areas, including you've researched in Sierra Leone and Germany, but you've also explored the discipline of anthropology itself. And today we want to focus on your work with homeless people mainly, but perhaps we could begin with you telling us how you got to this point in your career.
Of course, yeah. Thanks so much for having me, first of all. And so I think, generally I'm interested in intimacy, violence and law. So I've always explored questions around these kinds of frictions between movements which push towards greater rights or kind of taken for granted notions of how people live and what sort of basic rights they need and they enjoy, and then the lived experiences on the ground. For many years I've been really struck by the fact that we have both, in Western Europe, we have both a very well-functioning aid system, or so we claim, and at the same time we have a problem with houseless individuals that is steadily growing. And there's different explanations for this, of course, but when you look at the side of research and also at the side of policy, people are very much interested in finding out, what puts people on the streets, like kind of capital movements or lack of housing or more short-term jobs and these kinds of things. But what people don't really explore is how, when somebody's on the street, they can claim basic rights and protections like intimacy, privacy, family life, children, and so on. And that's what's really, really interested me, and where there's a kind of continuation from my very early research, where I followed asylum seekers, and then I did research in Sierra Leone with people who had been imprisoned for sleeping with their girlfriend, their intimate partners, but that was not legal. And so it was always this kind of question, what happens when your life doesn't fit the kind of box that it needs to fit in order to claim certain rights and protections. I've been doing this research since 2018 now, so it's going on 3 years. Maybe so much for him.
I'm so struck actually by what you're saying in terms of that, is that we do tend to view people within the homeless population, we do view them through that prism of what's contributed to their situation and their histories of trauma, that sort of thing, and don't think that much about their needs for intimacy and privacy. And I suppose there's something quite striking about your free thinking ability to come up with that as a novel area that's richly deserving of exploration. I wondered how it is, why you've managed to buck against the trend and come up with something that, that seems quite innovative, or very innovative?
So I think this is largely not due to me, but due to anthropology as a discipline. So I take this idea of long-term engagement with people very, very seriously. So of course, I had my kind of core areas, right? Which is intimacy, and broadly speaking, intimacy is about much more than we think it is, right? It's about family life, it's about love, it's about privacy. And so I was interested in how people who are on the streets can live this. But then, I mean, for the first year of my research, I spent day in and day out with the people I would then be doing research with and alongside, and I try to figure out what matters to them and how. And only then did I understand this fundamental disconnect, right? It wasn't clear to me. I thought maybe I would be doing an ethnography around partnerships on the streets, or you know, families on the streets or something like this. And it took this this ethnographic work to understand that despite us claiming that we have these fundamental rights and protections, we do base them on tenancy protected housing, and those who don't have it can't claim it. And how striking that actually is, considering how Western Europe sees itself. So I think it's mostly due to the discipline of anthropology, actually.
So your recent paper, which has got the terrific title, "Let Me Take a Vacation in Prison Before the Streets Kill Me, Rough Sleepers Longing for Prison and the Reversal of Less Eligibility in Neoliberal Carceral Continuums," is a beautifully written paper, I think.
Thank you.
And there's a phrase in the abstract, "Turn the carceral grip into an embrace." And I think that really grabs our attention and our imagination straight away. But I found it difficult to relate this rather benign characterization to the prison system that I know in the UK. Is this a particularly German system that you're describing?
No, actually, it isn't. And so let me begin maybe with a disclaimer. This paper isn't saying that prison is benign in any ways, or that prison takes away, that there's no punishment, there's no deprivation, there's no hardship and isolation connected to punishment. But there's something else going on as well, and that's not that unique to Germany. But if we take the German case as an example, we can kind of understand why. Maybe let me begin with what I was seeing during my research, and then how this relates to the kind of structural changes that occurred. While I was doing this research, and I still am doing this research, but it came up more and more that prison was a very common denominator in many people's stories. So most had been in and out of prison, they had open warrants, they knew they would be doing time again. And I thought that this would be extremely difficult for them, and they would, do their utmost to avoid prison, but actually many really didn't. So while for some prison wasn't a big problem, others really tactically thought ways to actually be imprisoned. So they would exchange information about where ticket controllers are in the tram so that they would get caught, so that they had, they accumulated fines so that they needed to go to prison. They would stage fights in public when they knew that police would be nearby in order to be caught. And there were all these things going on, and I just couldn't ignore it. And so I began to ask what is happening here, and why do these people seek out prison? And there's two contradictory trends. One is that within the penal system, we have a move towards rehabilitation, right? So this predominant idea of prisons as places of deterrence, it's still around, of course, but the main aim is rehabilitation, which means that actually in prison you have an aid system that comes together, right? People who enter prison, they're medically insured, they have access to social workers, they have access to probation officers later on. They can, if they so want to, set the steps to exit houselessness, for instance, if they want to find housing again, or if they want to find work again. Most work in prison as well, so they do also save some money. And there's a contradictory trend that is happening within the aid system, and that is a trend towards responsabilization, where in the current climate we say that all the aid is there, so if you're on the streets, it's your own responsibility, and to find a pathway out is also your own responsibility. Now, of course, you also have all the different aid institutions that you need there, but they're fragmented. You need to seek them out, you need to find them, and you need to actively look for help. Many people who are on the streets are not able to do that. So for them, paradoxically, when they end up in prison and this structure is there, they then begin making use of it. And I've documented many stories where, for instance, people with health issues, they didn't have proper insurance outside because they weren't registered or for whatever reason. They couldn't claim the treatments that they needed outside, but they then got them while they were doing time. There was also family reunification stories and all of these things. So I think on the one hand, it's a very particular case, right? It considers and concerns rough sleepers who are already marginalized within society, who are dependent on aid, and who are already not really living in normative society. And it considers shorter prison sentences, right? So this is 30 days up to 3 years, and not really, really long sentences with really long criminal records after. But it's really something that that also when I talk to colleagues now, that is a story that that does also accompany imprisonment, that for some people it's a bad thing, but it's not only a bad thing. And I think this is really something we need to take very, very seriously.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, Louisa, resonates in terms of when I worked in a local prison where people were, it was a rapid turnaround of people coming in for quite short sentences, and also community forensic work, and also in talking with friends who are lawyers that work as defence lawyers for legal aid cases. And I think especially with people who have problems with substance misuse, people could see that going to prison could actually help them have an enforced break in that cycle, which is, I know people talk about how readily available substances are in prison, but I think if somebody wanted to detox and try to break that pattern, prison at times did offer them that. But I mean, it feels like a very sad reflection of society that people see prison as the positive way forward from a position that presumably feels much worse.
Yeah, it really is. I think so. First, this is a very, very good example that I also saw a lot for several reasons. One, because it's extremely hard to get into a detox center while you're on the streets. You have to call every day. You're on a huge waiting list. If you don't call once, you don't get in. And if you do get in, it's only for 30 days. However, if you begin this kind of treatment in prison, then it's much, much easier for your social worker and your caseworker to get a space for you in a long-term facility, right? So that really is a way around. And to your second point, yes, it really is, because it doesn't tell us what's right with the prison. It tells us what's wrong with the aid system, and where we really have to pay attention, because we're not managing to reach people the way we should. And I think it's largely due to, yeah, this idea of responsabilization and the notion of subjectivity, of personhood that goes with it. Right, where we think, I mean, it's this idea of less eligibility, where we think if we offer people too much, then they will not, out of their own drive change their situation for the better anymore. But because we have this negative image, we create a system that makes it extremely hard, almost impossible for people to succeed. And so they use their agency to find other ways. And one of these ways is prison.
In a way, this is making me rather depressed, because many years ago, I worked with homeless men in Oxford. And there was a pattern of men going to prison repeatedly for short periods. And that was mainly for drunkenness. There wasn't much in the way of drugs around. And they'd come out looking sober and tidied up, which would last for a little while, because there wasn't any sort of aftercare. And so in some ways, yeah, things haven't really changed very much. But I still don't, to be honest, I don't recognise the degree of support that you've been describing, both in your paper and just now, in prisons over here. But perhaps, Naomi, you're saying there is that degree of support which men can access.
Well, I kind of thought Louisa summed it up when she said it's not necessarily that prisons are hugely supportive, but that actually there's such an absence of support for people if they're not in prison. And I think Louisa's point about kind of like people coming in for short-term sentences perhaps gives a different sense of the prison system than if people are facing a very long stretch inside. But there's something maybe about the structure, and if you're living in a chaotic life with little structure outside, maybe sometimes the boundaries and parameters that are put in place just by being imprisoned offer something to individuals that where there's so little in their lives.
Yeah, I thought, Louisa, and you'll have to tell us what you really think, Louisa, I thought you were saying that staff in prisons were really incentivised to care. I mean, you have this quote from one of the homeless men: they care because it's secretly about them. Another great quote.
Yeah, well, they are incentivized to care because, well, since the penal system rests on this idea of rehabilitation, if they fail to rehabilitate people, then the prison system also fails, right? So in some sense, the critique that rough sleepers are making here is, suddenly they're there and they want to work with us, but it's not because, you know, out of the goodness of their heart or because suddenly they realize our plight, but it's their job because they have to justify why they're putting us away, and they're justifying putting us away by way of punishing us, but also rehabilitating us. So they need to do something with us. Now, I do, of course, also agree with your former point. This isn't like a clear road and it works for everyone. It really doesn't. I also have these cases where people go in and then they come out and they're sober and they have saved up a little bit, and then some weeks later they're back to where they were. So it's not a solution to the problems that is there. It's just to say that for some people it really is a way out and a way up. And for some people, it is a break. And for some people, it, you know, they then return to their previous structure. But they still had this break.
Okay, thank you.
Louisa, how did you go about doing your research? How did you make contact with people who were homeless, and why Leipzig? Did that have particular significance?
Yeah, so I did a mapping of a lot of German cities, and then I decided on Leipzig for several reasons. One, because it was formerly GDR, and so it claimed not to have had any problems with houselessness, right? Because everybody had been housed. Of course, the reality is quite different, but so the story goes. And now this is a kind of a new problem, and the aid structures that are there are still relatively new and also a little bit flexible, and they're still kind of working out the perfect way for them. At the same time, there's massive restructuring happening within the city, where a lot of unclaimed space has now been bought by investors and is going to be turned into like new districts, modern districts. And so there's a huge move happening where people who could live in these unclaimed spaces before are now pushed out. How I've been doing my research, well, so it was really important to me to first understand who is on the streets and why, and then how their lives unfold. So I didn't want to go only through organizations because then we have, we get an image of people who use the aid system. Where spaces are, where people who don't have housing gather, how they make use of the city, where they could sleep, where there's free food and so on. And so I also did introduce myself to all the aid organizations that are there, and I introduced my research and I said, you know, let's collaborate and communicate. And I also did a little bit of research with people there, but mostly with those who are really out. It took me about half a year to have the first kind of connections to people, and then it sort of built from there, right? They checked me out, they figured out whether they trusted me and whether they liked this research or not, and then they introduced me to other people. And this made it possible to, I mean, for instance, I have a lot of research collaborators who are like 70 and older, and who live on the streets completely in hiding. And I have a lot of really young people, and also people who are employed and people who study for A-levels and so on. So that made it possible to gain this like huge variety of people and not focus mainly on this, on people who, for instance, frequent the main station or frequent the aid system that we're kind of used to already.
Sounds like you're really speaking of the need for quite slow, patient work and how valuable having a build-up of time is in building relationships. If you want to hear people's stories and get to grips with it, because I guess quite often when research projects happen, there's a wish to have a kind of like a quick fix, you know, of research and quickly make contact and quickly get results and be able to turn that around. My guess is that your discipline encourages that way of working, but is that something that you found a challenge in terms of having universities on side with doing that kind of slow, painstaking work?
It really is, because research is becoming faster. And right, we now have this idea that like you have your PhD research, which is like, I mean, in anthropology, you have 12 or 18 months, and then after that, it's usually shorter projects. But I realized really quickly that both with the themes I'm working on, so if you really want to talk to somebody about intimacy, it's not going to be possible when you don't really know them and they don't really trust you, and you sit down and you're some stranger and you're asking them about like the most intimate details of their lives. And I also really believe that, I'm working on social issues, and I believe that if we want to understand something, properly understand something, we need to give it the time. And so this is what I've always argued. And I mean, luckily at the Max Planck Institute, I found the support I needed to do that kind of research. And I'm also realizing now, I mean, it's almost 3 years, and I have these connections to social workers and to the city and so on, where now that I have spent all of this time and I can say something about parts of these people's experiences, I then also become an asset to people who are trying to figure out how to make the system better, or why they can't reach people, or why things don't work. So I think in some ways it is, of course, an investment. But I do believe that with topics like this, we need to spend the time, and then it also I mean, it should pay off in the end, hopefully.
And can you tell us something about the research findings that you've come up with, and also where you see that going forward?
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of understanding how people live privacy and intimacy, it's really the case that people cannot, which means that based on this aid system that individualizes, it is really impossible for people on the streets to, if they want to go through the aid system, to live relationships, to live family life, to hold on to their children. And this causes a multitude of problems. One is that many people decide to stay on the streets but stay together rather than going through the aid system. People hide their status, especially if they have children, or they stay in situations that are extremely unhealthy. For instance, violent relationships and so on, because they know if they would leave that space and they would declare themselves as being houseless and in need of support, they would lose custody of children. So what I've been trying to do also in communicating with social workers and practitioners is that we need to get rid of this individualization. Within the aid system, we need to have a system for couples, for families, because otherwise you're losing all of these people. And you are, interestingly, it's very often a break in the social structure that renders people houseless, much more than it is the loss of a job or addiction, or, you know, these are sort of follow-up problems to that break. And if you create an aid system that upholds this, then, you know, you're not getting out. So that is one thing. And the other thing is that when it comes to this issue with imprisonment, I'm trying to build a bigger project that looks more closely into what really happens also with, like, more long-term sentences. And trying to follow people as they move in and out of prison. But what I've already been doing is, speaking to probation officers, sharing this kind of information. And I mean, it's not like lawyers know it too, judges know it too, right? Because they have these people in the courtroom again and again, and they're trying to keep them out, and they don't want to stay out. And they come back. So here we're trying to find solutions for maybe offering them in collaboration, for instance, with there's organizations who offer healthcare, helping them understand that people in need of treatment also need treatment. It's a basic right. Don't let them go to prison, because the social costs of this are much higher in the end to all of us. Right. And then a third thing that I've been doing is, of course, the pandemic happened, and that made it imperative to very, very quickly understand where people are and what people need, and also what we have to do in order for houseless people to actually use services. And so there we created, between the entire aid system, a kind of network where we then decided how to react, and where actually a lot of changes within the aid system were made, also for the first time based on what rough sleepers actually said they want and need, because then, you know, it became a public health measure. So where now the question is which of these changes can actually stay, and how might we save something for the future.
So it sounds as if you've become something of an activist as well as a researcher. Is there any conflict there?
I think it is, if you're trying to push through your own ideas, because very often they get... what I'm learning in my research a lot is that I have my own ideas, my own opinions, and then they get stamped upon. and that I can never unlearn. So yes, I think I am. I mean, I'm doing socially relevant research, and I'm also trying to help it trigger social change. But I'm not supposed to be the a person whose voice matters here. I'm just the one who transmits the voices that are not very often heard, or that don't make it to the table, or that may not want to speak out themselves. So I am active, but hopefully not not based on my own ideology, but based on the data that
I've gathered. I was thinking that your descriptions of the lack of privacy and exposure that homeless people endure is very powerful in your paper, and it makes, to me, it seems to make the difference between kind of knowing and really knowing, because of course it's self-evident to all of us that people who are sleeping in doorways on the street must be exposed, but it's somehow different to get into the feeling of that. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, it is. And I think so none of the things that I'm doing are like really revolutionary. This is information that's kind of in front of us. But then understanding how it relates to choice and agency and the possibility to change this kind of situation or not, and what structures are behind it that that prevent people from moving out of this space. I think that is where the new information that comes from, and where we begin to understand that this is really an issue that, as hard as this sounds, but it could happen to any and all of us. And it's not self-evident that just because we then put our feet down and we are turning to all the places, that we will also make it out that easily. And I think that's why it's a problem that demands our attention and that we should fix.
You're incredibly modest and humble, Louisa. I was just thinking, you know, you dismissed the idea of you bringing something new and innovative and talk about, you know, these are kind of like basic, you know, observations, but actually you've had the courage to engage with something that lots of people have chosen not to engage with, and whether that be for whatever reason, whether that be too painful to engage with that feeling part. But yeah, I'm just really full of admiration for the fact that you have engaged with something that I think makes the experience of homelessness seem even more painful than the way in which we ordinarily dwell on it. You refer to Frankl and his idea that the last freedom is the freedom to choose your attitude towards circumstances, and I wondered if you, that might be related to my previous observation, but I wondered if you could say a little bit more about what you meant by that.
So I think in some ways this was my original idea of how people were speaking about the prison. I thought, well, okay, maybe they're doing away with, like, oh, you know, it's not bad, like it's fine, I actually want to go there, like I don't mind. That they might be talking about this because it's almost self-evident that prison will happen to them. They can't really escape it. So maybe they are claiming this plight as their kind of agency, as their will, and they're living accordingly. So it's, yeah, maybe if you're stripped of all the freedoms, then the freedom that you still have, and this is what Frankl is saying, right, is to choose the way you live it. But then, of course, what I realize is very different, that there actually is not just accepting plight and giving into this or even embracing it, but a really brilliant way actually to try to open up possibilities and to navigate freedom in the most unfree places we can think of.
Your descriptions of street space are very powerful and frightening, and yet you also describe a sort of fellow feeling and community. How far are homeless people able to support each other?
They really, really are. And I think that is both a gift and a curse. So there is, of course, people who live on the streets in isolation and who live in complete hiding. And then they usually don't have this support structure. But as soon as you choose to sleep in places that are kind of known within the community of houseless people as places that are sort of safe or semi-safe to sleep, or that houseless people frequent, you will very quickly encounter other people. And there are massive support chains for to enhance safety, to enhance protection, to make a living in these circumstances, right? Some people are better at making money, other people are better at building shelters, and very often I think there's a huge acceptability of people's differences. So you have all these different worldviews and you have all these different characters, and you have many people who have very complex multiple problems, problems that also make it hard to be around them for other people. But then there's this acceptance, and in some ways that is really great, and I think it does allow people to sustain the space despite it being an extremely difficult life. But it also creates a problem, because if you have this structure and then you have the individualized aid structure, you need to then leave the only people you are still frequenting, knowing, calling friends, and you're sort of suffering this life together. They're the only ones who really understand what it means. You need to leave them to make it out. And what I've seen quite a lot is that people who then do make it out and they have a roof over their head, they have their own apartment, they either go back to the main station or the park or every single day, or they don't stay in this space long and they leave it again, right? Because this there's this idea, right, that like home it's not just where the key fits, it's not just where you have four walls, but it's actually where you feel socially accepted and integrated. And so this community results out of a larger social marginalization. That is a huge problem. So these people are excluded from mainstream society, then they form these bonds, and then they make it through an aid system by themselves, and they're placed in housing that's very often also still excluded from mainstream society, and they're alone, and so they turn back. So I think this is also something that we need to understand and then better integrate people if we want them to successfully leave houselessness.
Yeah, as you were talking, it really made me think about how much we focus on things and giving people things in order to try and help them, when actually what you're speaking of is that human need for belonging, and that doesn't get given emphasis and weight and effort thrown at it in the same way, does it? Probably because it's a lot harder to solve than somebody physically needing a flat or what have you, but
yeah,
they're powerful.
Yeah, it really isn't. But I think at the same time, it's also, we don't need to like radically restructure society in order to improve things like this, right? We just need to think the aid system a little bit different. Like, for instance, don't move people into these humongous flats at the outskirts of the city where you have only other people who had been in similar circumstances. Use scattered housing principles, right? And immediately you have a person that is integrated into a neighborhood. Maybe don't just have people like work with social workers whom, you know, it's their job and they need to do that, but maybe give other groups a chance to come up with projects. I think there's really small ways in which we can tweak this, but it's true. It's a very easy thing to think, okay, what does a person need? A person needs 416 euros a month, a person needs access to the internet, a person needs access to a shower, a person needs a roof over their head. Okay, but many people leave this for people because that's more ultimately more important to them. So we must consider this.
So you've begun to answer this question already, Louisa, but I wonder what you think the implications for policy development and maybe training are through your ongoing research.
Maybe I just add on to what I was saying before then. So I think for policy, there's all these, first, there's already great principles out there that we can kind of build upon. One thing, of course, is this idea of housing first. Though, right where you take housing as the basis for addressing and overcoming social issues, and not as a kind of reward that you work towards. Another thing, of course, is to think about how we can close this gap between mainstream society or housed people and houseless people, and whether we want to encourage houseless people to use systems that are already there. Like, for instance, these social eating places, or the possibility to go to the theater, or, whether we can dock on with quite simple things to reintegrate. When it comes to prisons and how we can break this notion that people, go into prison and then face this deprivation of liberty and the records that come with it just to get a chance. I think here it's really imperative that we understand how fragmented the aid system actually looks for houseless people, and how difficult and sometimes impossible it is for them to understand where they must go for what. Now, there's no need to put the aid system back together, but we could give people a roadmap that helps them understand where to turn to for what. I mean, sometimes it's as simple as that, right? And we must increase communication between these different aid structures, like, for instance, the healthcare system and the houseless system, or family support units and the houseless system, right? Because then people choose one or the other. And so in doing so, we would close these gaps that make people fall through, and we would take away this need to go into prison. So this is, I think, mainly what I'm trying to communicate. And I think my last message would be that if you really want to understand what's wrong, then ask somebody who's affected by it. And if you spend time with them, you might actually be able to learn how they see things. Now, not all of this can be implemented, and not all of this has to be implemented, but very often we understand how a fix is possible without having to invest tons or reinventing the wheel, but just maybe putting things together a little bit differently.
One of the things that we talked about, Naomi and I, when we started thinking about doing this podcast, was how can we, or someone like you, be effective? How can we get our voice heard, or the voices of the people who are doing our podcasts heard, where it makes a difference? And because the struggle that I think we all probably have is of getting that voice heard, particularly by the politicians who can make decisions. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a very good question, actually. I think when you're doing research, I believe it's imperative that from the very onset of your work, you do introduce yourself to all the practitioners that are there, to the city you're doing your research in, to all the political parties that are around. And I can tell you that for me, for instance, nobody cared about this. Nobody knew who I was or what I was doing, and they thought, this is another whatever project and she's going to go away. But then if you consistently communicate without asking things back, there will come a time where suddenly your voice matters for something. Right? And so I believe that we have this problem that there's this gap between academic work and the world, when really there shouldn't be, and it's it's hugely our fault, right? We created this. So I think it's very good to think not only, okay, how can we advance academic debates, but how can you in a very straightforward way communicate what you're doing and why it matters, and then consistently communicate to whoever wants to listen or doesn't listen. And in my case, it took, I think, like two and a half years, and all of a sudden I was then invited into all these policy forums and practitioner forums. And it's not that I always have something great to contribute, and it's not that, right, but it's a different perspective, and it is being heard, and I think that matters. And I believe when it comes to, so I think podcasts and conversations and networking, all of these are things that are incredibly important and that we should really be doing more. And I think maybe sometimes we're too shy in sending them around, or like, in, you know, there's this negative image to self-promoting, but essentially it's not what we're doing, right? We're just trying to have conversations. So here too, I think I would send that to anyone and everyone, and just hope that somebody would then, usually it's a snowball, right? It's like you send it to 50 people, 49 are like, eh. And then one person is like, okay, that reminds me of something. And then the conversation continues in ways you might not have thought before. But I think we really have a responsibility to communicate what we're doing better. And I think it's also happening in a lot of places. So maybe this is a really good time to
be heard. I think you're echoing something that we were talking to recently. I think it was Michael West, wasn't it? Who said what really matters is persistence, doing things and saying things over and over again. And,
yeah, that's true.
So, can we move on then to the issue about, you've written about your very difficult experience of working in Africa. And in this, you cite the murder of Henrietta Schmerler and the crisis that this created within anthropology, which arose after that murder. Now, we've spoken to quite a number of anthropologists and criminologists, and we've often wondered, together with them and afterwards, about the kind of reflective support and supervision that they get. What do you think about this, and what are your reflections on that incident in Africa that you've described so powerfully?
I think that one big problem that we're having is that we are creating a kind of system of care and a system of preparation and a system of managing risks, trying to avoid risks, managing our own safety and the safety of those we do research with. And all of that is crucially important. It really is. But it creates this idea that it's possible to avoid dangers and violence and risk and harm, and it isn't, right? And I think this is one thing, and the other thing is that, again, it creates a kind of responsibility where researchers are made responsible for things that are completely out of their control. Right now, of course, it's extremely important that you think through your work and that you think about how you can protect yourself and the people you do research with and alongside, and what you can and should do in case something happens to you. But I think it's extremely counterproductive if we're trying to create an idea that it's possible for us to somehow manage to avoid getting harmed, because not only does that actually unprepare people, but it also creates a huge lack when something actually does happen, right? Where then the question no longer is, okay, something has happened, that's horrible, but anthropology and research in general is human engagement, and humans can do good and bad. All of us can, right? So we have to be prepared for this. And then the question no longer is, okay, what is it now that we can do? What support is there? But the question very quickly becomes, what went wrong? What went wrong? Who was wrong? Who is responsible? And because of this mismanagement system, we have turned our institutions into places that need to defend themselves as well, right? Okay, it wasn't our responsibility. We weren't at fault for whatever happened there. And so they defend themselves very often by putting researchers in the position of responsibility. And I think both of these things are really wrong and very problematic, and we should counteract them. And I think this is also what happened with this murder, right? That in order to... So the conversation wasn't so much around, okay, this horrible thing happened, that is very bad. How can we think about the work this person has done and what it means and how we can build on it? But it was very quickly an idea of this creates the illusion of a very dangerous world that we need to somehow control. How can we control this? We can control this by trying to understand what went wrong, which then also means by trying to understand what she did wrong. And then there were all these conversations around, exactly what she did and what of that was good and what of that was bad and what of that should be taught differently, when really it should have been much more about the work that she's been doing. And the fact, the very sad fact, that these things do happen, though not as often. I mean, it's not that we go out there and we're always hurt, but we can get hurt. And then the question is, how do we deal with that? And how do we create support systems and management systems that allow us to speak up and speak out about what happened without fearing that this will destroy our legacy, or it will turn us into people who are at fault and who are not capable of doing their work. Because if you're doing this, then if you're opening these channels, then you are actually creating more safety in the end, right? Because people can say when they're not comfortable, when they're not well, and they can gain and get the support that they need, rather than silently trying to navigate through things that are extremely difficult.
It was such a powerful paper, Louisa, really, really very powerful, and I think has a lot of direct relevance for people working in the criminal justice system, actually. So that sense of if staff are assaulted in prison, that kind of like sense of victim blaming that happens in order to, A, like you say, create less responsibility for the institution, that if it's the individual person's fault, then the institution doesn't have to take blame, and also so that, as you just mentioned, so that other people feel more safe, because actually if they accept that they could be assaulted at any point in time, that's really scary to be at work. But it also made me think of other ways that the criminal justice system tries to reduce risk rather than think about engaging with risk in ways that might be proactive and useful. So for instance, in the service that I work in, we'd often get men who would have written on their files not to be left alone with a woman because their offence has been against a woman and they've behaved in ways that have been considered dangerous to women whilst in prison. But actually, for us, a significant part of treatment has been the importance of creating safe enough circumstances for the person to be able to engage with a woman. Because if they can't engage with a woman, you end up with a sterile service where you can't actually see the man's risk and danger. So I think your paper really amplifies our experience of doing the podcast, that actually it's really important to listen to people who are talking about subject matter from quite diverse areas at times, because you can really learn some really valuable lessons and pick up some key learning from people that are operating in quite different fields. So anthropology does feel quite different in some ways, and yet your paper on sexual violence during research is really very profound and very important, I would say, for people to be reading.
So I was just going to say, because we have spoken with a number of anthropologists over the months that we've been doing this, including Andrew Jefferson, who I think you worked with a bit at Dignity. I was going through your list of publications earlier today. So we had a great conversation with him too. But again, we were struck by how lone and difficult the work that you do is. And so we wondered, how do you look after yourself? What kinds of things do you do or read or listen to that give you emotional sustenance?
Thanks, that's also a great question. So, well, one thing is that I chose to work on very difficult topics, and I knew that it's not going to be easy. So I did negotiate with Max Planck that I have regular supervisions. And that was, in the beginning, that was a bit of a difficult process because they weren't quite clear why, why I would need this, and it wasn't that usual, but I think it should actually happen much, much more. Also for the reasons that Naomi was just outlining, right? It can also happen when we transcribe data or when we listen to difficult interviews, or you never know the space in which it catches you. So I think it's important to be proactive about this. Another thing that I do, it's a very small thing, but I try to end every day with something positive. So, if there was a lot of death in the field or there was a lot of pain in the field, then still, no matter how difficult it is, I try to do something good. And if it's just taking a walk for 10 minutes or talking to a friend or something like this. And I think two more things. One is that because my research collaborators and I are sharing the space, they also really look after me, which is something that I'll be forever grateful for, but that also gives me a lot of strength, not only hearing their stories and hearing their suffering, but also understanding that the kind of human kindness that is there and the in their very difficult circumstances, the ability to think about how I'm really privileged, right? How I might be having a difficult time with something that's really... And another thing, a final thing I'm trying to do is communicate. So both with the research I'm doing and also with this notion of like safety and sexual violence and generally violence and harm. So I'm trying to create spaces for students and for upcoming researchers where we can have conversations about this before we do research, while we do research, and after we do research, so that there's no longer this idea of the lone wolf, right? And that doesn't mean that you can, many of the things are confidential that happen in the field and you can't share them. And you can also not just put your baggage down, you have to carry it. But you don't have to carry it alone. And I think if we are creating these communities of care in academia, then we will both be better and hopefully also do better. So that, I think, gives me a lot of strength.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think we feel privileged to have had this conversation with you, Louisa. Thanks very much indeed.
That's such a lovely note to finish on.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, really.
That was a really thought-provoking interview with Louisa, touching on themes that we often don't think enough about, I think, in terms of homeless people, and just that idea of when people are excluded from society, giving them a home doesn't transform them into belonging, and why then people perhaps then leave that home in order to leave for people, because the system doesn't really allow, doesn't take into account people's relationships, does it? And also kind of like reminded of how polyvagal theory has taught us that we need others to co-regulate ourselves into psychological safety. And if we're undermining those relationships and attachments, we're kind of asking people to choose between, you know, physical comfort and emotional comfort, which must be a really difficult choice to make.
Yes, and I thought she gave us a really good description of the anthropology process. You know, the way that she described travelling on the tram every morning, walking through the city, spending time for months, actually, with people and getting to know them, you know, gradually getting to know them properly. I thought, and of course, the other part of that is just how brave he is in doing this work, not just because of the kind of situations that she places herself in, although some of those have been intrinsically pretty dangerous, but because of the way that she challenges the established academic style of doing things. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.